That's the boundary of the whole, that's when the manifold sigma has a boundary. Okay. Otherwise, there's nothing else invariant in time. So there are.
And when people talk about the aerial operator, are they
talking about that? They're talking about that variety of thing, but sometimes they mean something in the context where it's not, where we haven't modeled out by just morphisms, in which case it could be the area of some fixed surface. Occasionally, but not commonly, it's the area of a surface defined by the value of some outer field. For example, the area of a surface where some scalar field is equal to zero. I think I've spoken to all the people who are actually taking this as a course, but let me emphasize again, if you are taking this as a course, you should speak with me sometime in the next few weeks about projects and possible projects, and just send me an email and we'll set up an appointment. Good. So now I'm going to switch gears. If there are no more questions, I don't expect, for people who haven't seen this before, or even who haven't seen it often, I don't expect that that looks comprehensible. I mean, it's a structure. And the language of quantum gravity is written in that structure. And I do not tag my emails. It's interesting. So people don't feed group up that often. Anyway. But the language of quantum gravity is written in the structure of label graphs embedded up to topology. We know quite a lot about the dynamics. We know quite a lot about the number of observables. I just told you two simple observables in the simplest case. What I'm going to do now is start from something that everybody does know, or I'll assume everybody knows, which is gauge fields. And I'm going to write down a couple of theories. And I'm going to begin the work of going from the quantization of the gauge fields to these descriptions of quantum theories of gravity. Okay. And today, going to consider just some three plus one dimensional space time. So I'm going to assume I have a classical space time, but without a metric. So my classical space time is some three manifold cross time. And I'm going to assume that there is a differential structure. So what that means is I know how to write functions on the manifold. I know how to write derivatives on the manifold. And I know how to write vector fields and one forms and things like that. The differential structure, I have functions, derivatives, one forms, in fact, just differential forms, vector fields, etc. Okay? And I assume that everybody here knows that basic differential geometry of functions, derivatives, forms, and vector fields, because I'm going to use them. Okay. And but no metric. What kind of dynamics can we write? And I'm going to start with electromagnetism and ask how much of electromagnetism can we write? Because a lot of what learning to work, the basic idea of quantum gravity is that the gravitational field is a quantum object. It's going to be represented by operators. So if the theory is background independent, we're working in a situation in which there's no classical metric. The metric will only occur through operators. And we still want to do a quantum field theory. And we want to do a quantum field theory which doesn't need a metric to define it. So what structures do we have available? And let's start with the simplest things and see what we can do. Okay. So one of the simplest things that we can do is electromagnetism. So the vector potential is a one form, and so that also defines my notation. By a lower index here, I mean it's a one form. There is the curvature, and I will be sloppy about use of indices. Is there anybody here who believes deeply in using indices and not using indices? I will tend to use indices. Okay, so I mean, some people would write F equals dA, and I will actually write FAB is dA, AB, by which I mean partial A, AB minus partial B, AA, and that's actually twice dA. Okay? So I have a two form, okay, which is the field strength, and a one form. Okay. Now, I also have, so this is the potential, the vector potential. I also have the electric fields. And remember, there is not a metric. So I'm going to say something that's going to surprise people. The electric field is actually a two-form. Now, the electric field you're used to seeing, you're used to thinking of as a vector. But it's actually not a vector. It's actually a two-form. And what that means is it's actually epsilon. There is, given the differential structure, epsilon ABC is the structure that I have. So I also have densities. And I don't have a metric, but I can raise and lower indices with the epsilon. So I can make a vector field by raising the indices, and actually, the fact that it has the epsilon here means it's a density. So this is actually a vector density. And it's going to be important to do field theory. All I'm doing is classical field theory, but I'm doing classical field theory without a metric. And a warning, so a couple of warnings. One of them, for people who are used to, who is all of us, except in this context, who are used to doing classical field theory where there is a metric. If you're used to doing classical field theory where there is a metric, you're very happy to go EA is the metric, QAB, EB. You're very happy to raise and lower indices. But you can't do that because there's no metric. Or if there's a metric, it's going to be an operator. So there's no raising and lowering indices. And you're also very happy to blindly go about taking off density weights by using the square root of the determinant of the metric. And you can't do that either. So you have to be honest about who is a form, who is a vector field, who is a density, because you don't have the metric around to let you trade one form for vector fields and densities for non-densities. And there's no natural density in the game. Okay? So there's a lot of habits of calculation. There's not a lot, but there are a number of habits of calculation that have to be broken. Okay? So, What of Maxwell's equations can you write? Well, you can write d of f equals 0, which is a way of saying dA fbc equals 0, but that's just an identity. And you can write partial a dA equals 0. Now, you might think you can't write that, because this is a partial derivative. But this is actually epsilon ABC partial A BBC, thinking of the electric field as a two-form. And because I think of the electric field as a two-form, a vector density can be, you can take the divergence of a vector density without a metric, because that's just the curl of a two-form. Okay. So this is well defined. So Gauss's law survives. Okay. Gauss's law survives. What about the rest of the Maxwell's equations? But they don't survive. The rest of the Maxwell's equations, like, you know, E dot is curl B and so forth, you can't, I won't go through the exercise, but you can't write them down without a metric. So this is the only part of Maxwell's equations that survive. Just Gauss's law. Because Maxwell's equations depend on it being the metric. So what can you write? Well, you can write F is equal to 0. And you can do something a little better than that. You can write F is a constant times the electric field, written as a two-form. Okay. So you can write that. So that's a theory given by Gauss's law and this equation, that F is proportional to E. Okay. So this is called the self-dual equation. And it survives. Now, notice, by the way, if you want to, again, a homework, if you have a solution to this, it satisfies Maxwell's equations, by the way. But the rest of Maxwell's equations don't survive. Okay. So this is all you have. And this, it's consistent. Why is it consistent? If I take d of this, the curl of this, then I get the curl of this, which is Gauss's law. So these are, this is a consistent set of equations. And this theory has a name. It's called the Abelian BF theory. And believe it or not, it was written down in recent memory that we know the people who did it. This, to my knowledge, this was invented independently by Descartes, Hussein, and Gary Horowitz. And it's actually an interesting theory, and we will study it. Not right now, but we will study it. Okay? Now, let me just say the obvious thing. Does this have any interesting solutions? Well, that depends on the topology of the manifold. Let me consider that the manifold is a free torus. If the manifold is a free torus, then it's like, it's like this room with the walls facing each other and the floor and the ceiling identified. And I can make a closed loop like that, say running from the floor to the ceiling, since the floor and the ceiling are identified, I can make a closed loop. And I can consider, let me call that loop gamma, and I can consider the integral of A on gamma. And I'm going to give that a name that's called T of gamma. And that's something, if you remember thinking about the Aharonov-Bohm example, you can have situations when the topology is non-trivial, when the magnetic fields, which are the Fs, are zero everywhere, but you still have non-zero vector potential. And in a manifold which is a torus, is a non-trivial case. And so this is a case where I can have an A such that D of A is zero everywhere, but the integral of A around a non-contractible cycle is not zero. And in fact, I can take that loop, and that loop, let me call it beta, and the one from the front of the back, and call it alpha. So there are three loops in the room, alpha, beta, and gamma. And T alpha, T beta, and T gamma are all independent variables. And so I have a space of solutions. I haven't even talked about the E's yet. So just as far as the A's are concerned, I have a three-dimensional space of solutions if there's a torus. So this is a theory that has content. And quantizing this theory is therefore an exercise which is worth doing, and we will quantize this theory. Okay, questions? I'm not going to quantize it here. Let's see. I don't quite have a hang of. What is there? Is there a canonical order? You're supposed to be black, but so it works. No, that's the point. You can't ever show three. You can just show two. Okay. Yes?
Yeah? It's a local theory? Because there is no C or anything, so how do you know?
It's described by Bessel differential equations.
In that sense.
Yeah, those are local differential equations. It's a local theory. Now, I've described to you a three-dimensional space of solutions. I certainly haven't demonstrated to you that they're all the solutions. And they're not, because the E's can also vary. Okay, but actually that has a finite dimensional. When you write down the whole space of solutions, it is finite dimensional. So they're not local degrees of freedom. There are no waves in that theory.
A question.
Yeah.
Just when you mentioned the Aharonov-Bohm phenomenon, did I hear you say correctly that one can have A's being zero, but its integral be not zero?
No, you have the curl of A.
The curl of A.
The B be zero, yeah. And the A's be not zero. Okay. One more thing I have to tell you about this theory. And then we're going to make a slightly more complicated theory. To do quantum mechanics, for better or worse, to do quantum mechanics, it's necessary to make a Hamiltonian formulation. This is not necessarily a great thing, but it's true. At least if you want to do more than just wave your hands about the path in a book, you have to make a Hamiltonian formulation. And to make a Hamiltonian formulation, you have to know what the Poisson brackets are. And I have enough information here to define the Poisson bracket, so I'm going to do that. The Poisson bracket of AA at a point X in the manifold and EBC at a point Y in the manifold turns out to be delta 3 XY epsilon ABC. So these are the Poisson brackets. And I should tell you that's equivalent to, can also write that in another way, AA of X. If I now use the epsilon and raise the indices here, say EB of Y. So some notation I did, but let me establish some notation, is that a twiddle always means a density. So that's a density weight one object. Okay, so now this is a density. Now if I multiply by the epsilon on both sides, I get a delta AB here and a delta 3 XY. Okay. But now, notice something. This is a density. This is not a density. This means that this could be integrated. Part of it, which is a density, could be integrated. What about this over here? If I'm going to integrate something, suppose I want to integrate dy. I can integrate this on y because this is a density. Therefore, this is a density in the factor y. So delta functions, we have to get used to something, which is that delta, in other words, the integral dy, delta 3 x and y, times, say, a function of x, is the value of that function. Y is the value of that function at x. And what that implies is that the delta function is a density on one of its indices, but not both. So there's no such thing in this theory as delta 3 of x minus y. This is an object that lives on R3, which has a metric. There's only delta functions of two separate things, which are defined this way, and it's asymmetrical. It's no longer symmetric, because it's a density on one of its arguments and not on the second. Okay. And I'm emphasizing these technical things, but these are the things that everybody screws up unless they're pointed out to you. Okay. And in fact, it's not just students. There's a lot of papers going through the 1950s and 1960s on fine gravity that are wrong, that made various claims, which were wrong because they weren't used to thinking carefully about what was a density and what was not a density in the absence of a metric. Okay. So these are the Poisson brackets. I want to make a somewhat more interesting theory. And to make a more interesting theory, I'm going to go from the case of electromagnetism to Yang-Mills theory. Okay. And maybe there are a few students who don't know Yang-Mills theory, so I'll tell you. Okay. So the idea is that all the objects I wrote down, like the A, now actually live in the algebra of SG2. And that means that if you have the Pauli matrices are the guys that have the multiplication rule tau I times tau j is I epsilon I j k tau k. So for example, 0, 1, 1, 0 minus I, and 1, 0, 0 minus 1. Are tau x, tau y, and tau z. And the A's live in the space that's spanned by the tau's. So A has the form of AI tau I, where always implicitly, if I have two indices, I sum. Similarly, the E, I write in that form, also is an object which lives in the Pauli matrices, the space of the Pauli matrices. So there are now three A's and three E's. And in the Poisson bracket, I have to specify which of these are, and there's a delta IJ. So when I use indices I, j, k, l, they equal 1, 2, and 3, and they label SU2 Pauli matrices. And whereas I use indices A, B, C to refer to the manifold. And so those are my conventions. Whoops. And then I have to be a little bit more careful about what the field strengths are. And I have to explain why I have to be a little bit more careful. So, a feature of over here, I'll put it over here, of the electromagnetic field is that there are gauge transformations in which the one form goes to the one form plus a derivative times a function. And then it's easy to convince yourself that the curl doesn't change. Now, when these guys are valued in the Lie algebra, it's a little bit more complicated. Now you have some function f valued also in SU2, and a gauge transformation is delta A is the covariant derivative of f, which is d of f plus the commutator of A with F, like that. When the commutator means the commutator of SU2 matrices, so this means DA, F, I, I'll take a Pauli matrix outside, plus epsilon I, J, K, up to a sign, I'm not going to get the sign right, phi J, AK. And then again, I think many of you have seen that before, but there's a couple of students who haven't, so just for you guys. And you can learn about this in, for example, John Baez's book about gauge theories, or talk to me. If you've not seen this stuff before, come and talk to me. If you're a mathematician, this is a section through a principal fiber bundle, if that helps. And I think if you haven't seen this before, send me an email or come talk to me and I can just explain it privately and put you on to some ways to think about it. It's like electromagnetism, but all the fields are valued in SU2, which is the Pauli matrices. And the F is now defined to be, it also has an index. And it's defined to be, I'll write it several different ways, dA, ABI, plus a half times the commutator of A with A. It's also dA, ABI, which has been before, plus epsilon IJK, AJ wedge AK, AB. Actually, I think the 1/2 is in that way of writing. And then the identity, there's now an identity that DA FBC is 0, which is D FAB plus the commutator. Let me write it that way. DF plus the commutator of A with F. And you can show that this is 0. Okay. So that's a Yang-Mills field. And now we want to do the same thing. And so I want to ask how... Which font?
Top line.
Ah, sorry, thank you. Thank you. Okay. Now I want to ask again, I'll work here for a moment. What field equations can I write? On this new manifold. So the first field equation I can write is a consequence of Gauss's law. So I can write the covariant derivative of E, where I define the covariant derivative here, equals 0. So this is like the Gauss's law, but it has a nonlinear term. So I can write this. And I can also write this. Everything is just the same with an index. So I can also write, and I'll just lower the index here. E is, did I write it? Oh, I wrote it the other way. Okay. 1 over lambda FAB. So I can write this and this, and it's very similar, only the E and the A and the F are valued in SUT matrices. And this is called SU2 BF theory. But that's not a very interesting theory, because that theory doesn't have any local degrees of freedom. Okay. And if lambda was 0, so this would just be 0, so it was just F equals 0, you could see that easily, that there are no local degrees of freedom. But it's still true if F is proportional to E. There are no local degrees of freedom. And I think I'll postpone proving that to you, because we are going to come back and study these theories. But this has an interesting solution space in cases where the free manifold has a non-trivial topology, but it has nothing local propagating in it. So I want to ask a question. Can I write a theory which has local degrees of freedom? Can I write a theory that has local degrees of freedom? Now, one way to see this is that this theory has no local degrees of freedom is that let's count fields. There are 9 A's. There are 9 E's. there is three such equations, because this is a matrix in the Pauling matrices. So there are three such equations. But there are nine such, there are nine equations here. Now, when you do the counting, you find out that there are a number of gauge conditions that can be imposed. And this is something we'll do carefully and we'll derive carefully later. But there's gauge transformations that I wrote there. So you can fix the gauge, and that's three conditions. So fixing the gauge on A gauge, is just like in Yang-Mills theory, that's three more equations. But this theory, again, I'm not proving this to you, but this theory is also invariant under the diffeomorphisms of space because there's no metric. And you can fix those, and that's three more equations. And when you're done, you have 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 9, which is 18 equations, and you have 18 degrees of freedom. So you have no degrees of freedom. You have 18 conditions on 18 equations. You have no degrees of freedom. The only way you can get a degree of freedom is to evade that by, that's times the points of the manifold. So you really have, it's really 18 times infinity minus 18 times infinity. And you can evade that by things like, if d of a is 0, then there a, the integral of a could still be non-zero on a non-trivial cycle. So you can evade it by topology, but that just gives you a finite number of evasions. So I want to get a real field theory, not a fake field theory. I want to get a real field theory. So how can I do that? Well, I only have a one-form, a 3 1-forms, value in SU2, and 3 2-forms, or equivalently vector density, value in SU2. Okay. Let's try to keep Gauss's law, because Gauss's law is nice and familiar to us. Let's try to keep Gauss's law. If we want to get some local degrees of freedom, we have to have fewer field equations. Right? Because we had the number of field equations plus gauge fixing conditions equal the number of variables. Well, we could break the gauge, but actually we wanted diffeomorphism invariant theory because there's no metric in what sense could it mean. And anyway, secretly we want a theory of gravity. So we're not going to break the gauge. We could just introduce a bracket on metric, we could break the gauge, and then we could write down Maxwell's equation, the Yang-Mills equation. Okay, which breaks diffeomorphism. But we don't want to do that. So how are we going to get a theory with local degrees of freedom? Well, we've got to have less field equations than these. Because that's 9 field equations, which we did really not just down to 0. So how can we have fewer field equations? That's the question. How can we have fewer field equations? Well, I'm going to give sort of that thing a name. So I'm going to be interested in FAB, the sign of lambda doesn't matter. Let me keep everything consistent. Minus lambda, and I'll write it out completely, epsilon ABC, BCI. So let me give that a name. I'm going to call that script F. No, that's going to be something I want to use later. Sorry for being confused. Someone call that J. Okay. Now, if you think back to Maxwell's theory, that's basically B minus E. So it's the self-dual degrees of freedom. If you happen to know it, if there was, if lambda was imaginary, this would be how you would describe left-handed photons, or left-handed excitations. So there's a notion of chirality coming in here, but I'm not going to make lambda imaginary for the moment, because then I have to make all the variables complex. And I will eventually have to do that, but I'm going to keep them all real at the moment. Okay? So setting J equals zero is too strong. But I don't have much else. Roughly speaking, if I want something which transforms nicely under gauge transformations, I have F and I have E. And this is one combination. So I have to make some other combinations of F and E. Okay. So there's not much I can, and I have no metric. So there's not much I can do. Now some people here know the answer. So I'm not going to play a game of guess, but some people here actually know the answer. There's actually three things you can do. And just three things you can do to write field equations, to write less than 9 field equations. And by the way, they're consistent. I can't just write any set of field equations. They have to give consistent evolution rules, right? So I don't just get to write anything down. So we're going to have to worry. I proved to you that J equals zero and Gauss's law were consistent with each other, because you take the curl of J and you get Gauss's law. So I'm going to have to write down consistent things. And there's only three things you can write down. I know the answer, so I'll tell you. Okay? You can take J and you can contract it with E. By the way, I can raise and lower the internal gauge indices, these delta ijks that are valued in SE2. There is a delta ij. There's a metric on the Lie algebra, and I can raise and lower those indices all I like. So I can write this, and this just has one index, and that has a name, it's called dA. And I can set that equal to zero. And that's three equations. Okay. Then I can do one more thing, which is I can do that twice. Because look, the point is J has two lower indices. The E has an upper indice. So all I can really do is get rid of upper and lower indices with respect to each other, because there's no raising and lowering of the space-time indices. So I can take one E and contrast it against one index, or I can take J, I can contract it against two E's. And then I have to do something about the gauge indices. There's a J and a K, but I can tie that up. There's this invariant epsilon IJK in the group. And that's such a pretty thing, and that's going to be set equal to zero. Well, that's going to be called something, which is C, and then we're going to set it equal to zero. But before I set it equal to zero, I'm going to write it out. So I can do that. Actually, I lied. There's only two things you can do.
Especially you can't do this with the abelian case.
Right. So this I can't do with the abelian case. This I could do with the abelian case. But this I can't. But in fact, you need... Yeah. But this I can't. Okay. Now, for everybody who hasn't seen this before, take a deep breath and consider This is now, we don't have nine equations, we have four equations. So we have fewer equations. So we have a chance to get, when I do this subtraction, you have a chance to get local degrees of freedom. And it looks like we're going to get 5 degrees of freedom. Because 18 minus 7, 4 plus 3, is that right? Well, 4 plus 3 plus 3 is 10. Minus
9 minus 4 is 5.
9 minus 4 is 5, yes, thank you. Okay. So it looks like we get a theory with 5 degrees of freedom. And that should be confusing because the E and the A are conjugates, so that's phase-space degrees of freedom. And you're not supposed to have an odd number of phase-space degrees of freedom, but we'll come back and fix that in a minute. Okay? So everybody take a deep breath, and these... three plus three plus four equations are the Einstein equations.
So, within this context, are there three by Maxwell's equations?
I mean, no.
They don't.
No, they do not imply the angle of the equations, nor vice versa. Okay. These equations, I should give this a name. Let me call this GI. GI equals C equals VA equals zero are the same thing as the Einstein equations. But I just haven't told you the translation. In fact, to be precise, in the case that the fields are real, these are Euclidean. I can't spell. Euclid. These are Euclidean, E-U-C-F, oh my god. They're the Euclidean Einstein equations.
And the 2 degrees of freedom left are the two gravities.
And the 2 degrees of freedom left are the gravity. Although showing that is highly non-trivial. But not that non-trivial, and we'll do it next time, we're not going to do it this time. Okay? More precisely, C and D, just to tell you more precisely, C translates to the, if you're used to writing the Einstein equations as G mu nu Einstein tensor equals zero, then C is the G zero zero equation, DA is the G zero A equation, and the other equations, the GIJ equations are the same thing as E dot is given by the Poisson bracket of E with C. So actually, C is related to the Hamiltonian. But that's something I'm going to explain next time.
I'm sorry, DA is equivalent to G, what is the index? Very long.
G00, the 00 part of the Einstein
equation.
The 0A part of the Einstein equation. Okay. Now, what I will do before quitting is tell you, without proving it, the translation, and then I'm going to write down the Sitter spacetime. Because actually, the Sitter spacetime is already on the board. You just don't recognize it. But to make the translation to the Einstein equations, I have to tell you just a little bit about the Hamiltonian, what it means to make a Hamiltonian form of a theory. So I'm just going to tell you the bare minimum. If this is a space-time, M, been given a time function, so some way, some function t, which slices, so this is a real live manifold with a g nu on it, and you can put a time function such that del a t, which we can call t a, I'm sorry, del mu t, so I'm using mu now for my four-dimensional indices, this timeline, which makes sense because I have a metric. And then I can consider a t equals constant slice. So here's the slice. There is a three, the slice is a three manifold. So I'll call that sigma. That's a three manifold. And I can take the metric and I can pull it back to a metric on the three manifold. Because forms pull back, guys with lower indices pull back. So this is the three metric. And I can take the sample symbol and I can pull it back because it's really a form on that index, say KL. And I can pull it back and get an object, what I'm going to call it, little gamma, which is a connection on the three manifold. Let me see if that's the right way. I'm just trying to think of the right way to say this. Saving. I want to. There's a lot of stuff that we're going to have to define. I want to save time. And given that what we're doing is Euclidean, I can save time. So here's, I think the easiest thing to do is to ask you to trust me on the following thing. The connection in four space-time, the Gestapel symbol, can be seen as making a parallel transport which preserves the group SO4, which is the rotations in four-dimensional space. So the space-time connection gamma really has an SO, is like the Anil's theory for SO4. And SO4 is SU2 plus SU2. And those people who know some particle physics are used to thinking about taking things that transform under SO4 and splitting them into those two SU2s, which are called SU2 left and SU2 right. And this has to do with chirality. And this is a structure that we're going to discuss at length, but I want to end with a pretty statement. So I think if these are things you don't know, they're things we're going to develop next time. So I can take the space-time connection and split it into a piece which I'm going to call the left-handed part of the space-time connection and the right-handed part of the space-time connection. And then I'm going to pull the left-handed part back to the three manifold, because it's like the Yang-Mills field in SU2, and that's going to be my A. So what this A is that we've been talking about, which lives in SU2, is actually a gauge field for the left-handed part of the space-time connection, pulled back to the three manifold. It's a gauge field, it's a form, it can be pulled back to the three manifold. Now, that's what the A is. And next time we will go carefully through the little facts, the phenomenology that I just talked about, is thinking about the connection in Einstein's equations, like in SO4, Yang-Mills field, and splitting it into the left and right part. Now, meanwhile, there are frame fields. And a frame field is a way to write a metric where you have a orthonormal basis at each point. So a frame field EAI are three vector fields at each point such that when you take their inner product, EAI, EBJ, and you take their inner product with the free metric, you get delta IJ. And if you invert that, then QAB can be written as EAI, EBI, where E is the vector field, which is inverse to the one-form field B. So this, which is EAI, EAJ, is delta IJ. So if you know the metric, you know how to take dot products between three vectors. And if you know at each point three vectors, which are orthogonal to each other, you know the metric. And these vectors are called EI. They're those with downstairs indices, which are one forms, those with upstairs indices, which are the vector fields. And they're equivalent to giving the metric, and the metric can be constructed in terms of them. It's also true that the determinant of the metric with downstairs indices, square root, is the determinant of E. And having said all that, this object we've been working with, E twiddle AI, is this object, let me just call this E, the determinant of the metric, of the three metric times the frame field for the metric. And therefore, I'm going to come back over here because now I'm going to expose to you the center space. So what that means is that the three metric with indices upstairs times its determinant of the metric with indices downstairs is EAI, EBI. So that's one piece of the translation from the three metric to the frame field. And the other piece of the translation is, again, that AI is the SU2 left part of the space-time connection with the sample symbol, if you like. Okay. Now, having said all that, any questions? And I apologize, I'm a little bit, maybe I should have inverted this and just taught you all the things I just said, but then this would be a boring lecture. So I want to come to the punchline. And the punchline is the following. I would like to solve these equations. And there's, which are the Einstein equations. At least I'm telling you that there are four of the Einstein equations plus this other sort of Gauss's law-like equation. And it's generally hard to solve these equations, but there is one very obvious set of solutions. And the very obvious set of solutions, the obvious solution, is on the board, because it's where we started. Where we started was with J. So the obvious solution is J equals zero. And let's explore that solution. Now, obviously, D and C check J equals zero. But I have to check consistency with Gauss's law. But consistency with Gauss's law is easy because del A EA is equal to 1 over lambda epsilon ABC del A FBC, but that's equal to 0 identically. So Gauss's law checks as well. Now, the remaining equation, the E dot equation, is I'm asserting, gotten by taking the Poisson bracket of E with C, so we'll have to do that in a minute. Okay? So let me take an ansatz. Let's see if we can really find a solution. So look, A is a 3x3 matrix. And if I want to find an explicit solution, of course, I'm free to break the gauge invariance, I'm free to break the general coordinate invariance, and just write something explicitly down. So let me just take an ansatz that this is the delta. It's just the diagonal matrix. It's a 3x3 matrix. Times some function of time, and we're going to find that function of time. And dimensionally, because I know the answer, if you like, we have to get the lambda in somewhere. So there's going to be a square root of lambda over 3, which will be very useful to put there. And I haven't given lambda a name yet, but it will start to become clear what lambda is. Okay? Well, the next thing we should do is compute F. And F is del A, AB, anti-symmetrized, plus epsilon IJK, AA, J, ABK. This is a spatial derivative. This just has a function of time in it. So this term goes away. You get an epsilon times two deltas. So this is just epsilon ABI. I'm sorry. I'm messing up somewhere. That's the only thing it can be. And it has a lambda over 3 in it and an F squared. And then I want to solve J equals 0. But J equals 0, J is this, so it says that E times epsilon is 1 over lambda times F, so that tells me that E AI, I get an epsilon contracting with an epsilon, so not surprisingly, I just get something proportional to the unit matrix again. I get an F squared. And the lambdas go away, and I was dumb, and I should have put a lambda over 3 here. Will anybody be upset if I change the definition of things? So E is just F squared delta. Not surprisingly, therefore, QAB is also F squared delta AB, although you have to divide through by the determinant to find that out. Okay. That is, to get to Q, I have to find this object, take the determinant, and invert, and I'm going to save you time. But when you're all done, Q with lower indices is just also proportional to F squared. And I set it up that way, so that wouldn't come out. Okay. Now, I'm almost done. There's one more equation. And the one more equation is this evolution equation. Okay. And since I'm mainly showing this to you for its entertainment value, and we want to stop soon, I'm going to just ask you to take my word, and we'll come back and derive this. It's not actually that hard to do. But the evolution equation, I just want to not apply it completely, so get the factors right. The evolution equation, when all is said and done, well, let me tell you, you define a Hamiltonian, which is the integral over the three manifold of C. And to define that integral, C is a double density. If you go back to C, it has two powers of a density. So you need an inverse density there. It's natural to take 1 over square root of Q, C. So then it's a nice, well-defined object. And then the equations of motion are anything dot is the Poisson bracket of A, that anything with a Hamiltonian. We will come back later to why the Hamiltonian is related to an equation of motion. Again, for those people who know it, this is all about theory being constrained theory and having a lot of gauge invariance in it. But we'll come back to that. And when all is said and done, F dot is, well, let me give this thing a name, possibly a function of time here, if we don't say that, is N times lambda over 3 times F to the fourth. It turns out to be natural to say that N goes like 1 over F cubed. That's, if you like, the kind of gauge choice. But actually, sorry, it's even simpler than that. There's the 1 over square root of determinant Q there. So that comes automatically, that 1 over the determinant of Q goes like 1 over F cubed. So F dot is square root of lambda over 3 F. And now people should recognize that as the center space. F equals e to the ht, where h is square root of lambda over 3. And the metric is minus dt squared plus e to the 2 square root of lambda over 3 t times dx squared. Okay, and that's the Sitter space time. So I cheated a little bit in what I explained to you about the equations of motion, but let me say in words what happened, and then I'll stop. What happened is that it turns out, and some people may know this and some people may not know this, that De Sitter space has a beautiful property. And in fact, it's the only, in the Lorentzian version, it's the only manifold with a cosmological constant that's a solution to the Einstein equations that has that property, which is the property that J vanishes on it. So it's not just a solution of the Einstein equations, it's a solution of a simpler set of equations, which rather than being second order in derivatives, are first order in derivatives. The condition that J is zero says something like the B fields are proportional to the E fields. So it's like in electromagnetism, certain kinds of waves where E is equal to IB, only there's no I there. And that, it turns out, is because time is Euclidean. So these are what are called self-dual solutions. They're very special solutions with the with its relationship between the electric and the magnetic fields. And by translating Einstein's equations into equations for a gauge field, what we find out is that De Sitter space-time is related to a self-dual solution. In other language, say coming from Yang-Mills theory, solutions where the electric field is proportional to the magnetic field are called instantons. And once you've translated Einstein's equation into a gauge theory, then De Sitter space-time is an instanton solution of the theory, at least its Euclidean version. So that's what happened. You had a question.
Yeah, but why is De Sitter space the only solution? Because I have, let's say, smart for De Sitter, for example.
It's not a solution with J equals zero.
So it's not the fact that you do that answers that makes it into De Sitter.
No, in fact, let me be precise. In the Lorentzian version, where there's an I here, the statement that I said is right. And the Lorentzian version is significantly more constrained because everybody then has real and imaginary parts. And the equations are much more constraining. In the Euclidean case, where everybody is real, then there are many solutions, and in fact, there was an industry among relativists to manufacture solutions. They were called gravitational instantons, and there are many self-dual Euclidean solutions. In fact, there's a whole configuration space of them, and it has a very beautiful structure, which is studied by Donaldson theory and so forth. So there's a lot of interesting structure there. Which again, I'm kind of a little bit giving a preview. Those are things we'll get to. I want to write two more equations and then I want to stop. But is there any question? Supposing that I was dumb, and I wanted to quantize gravity in the old-fashioned way. Now this is just a little bit of phlegm. Okay. Then I would take as the variable the three metric, and there would be some conjugate momentum to it, which we can call pi ab, which would be the conjugate momentum to the three metric. And I would have to work really hard. And let me see what I don't want to erase. Okay. I can put it here. And after I got done working really hard, I would have the Einstein equations in Hamiltonian form in terms of the Q and the pi. And in fact, if I translate into the variables that we have using the translation that I have there, you could translate. And if you translate, then C, in terms of Q and its conjugate momenta, turns out to be this object, 1 over square root of Q, QACQBD, pi AB, pi CD, plus the plus square root of Q times the Ricci scalar of the 3 metric, plus lambda times square root of Q. And D, written in terms of Q and pi, would be the covariant derivative in 3 space of pi AB equals 0. And on the phase space of general relativity, this, when you go through the translation, is equal to this. And this is equal to this. And now I want you to compare the equations and understand why nobody made any progress in quantum gravity until 1986. This equation and this equation are polynomials. This is a cubic plus a fourth order polynomial in the field. This is the same thing. You know, this is just a cubic polynomial in the fields. This is not polynomial at all. It has both Q, and in here is the inverse of Q. It has the determinant of Q with the square root. So, and similarly, this has in it the Gustafel symbol. The Gustafel symbol, you know, has Q inverse times derivatives of Q inside of it. So these equations are horribly non-polynomial. They involve square roots of determinants, of inverses, and so forth. And these equations are simple polynomials. In fact, they're simpler than the Yang-Mills equations. So the reason why there's a course to teach, the reason why progress could be made after 1986, is that we can turn these equations into operators, honestly. Whereas nobody ever succeeded in turning these equations into operators. So that's why this approach to quantum gravity has made some progress. Question? Yeah.
On this side of the board, what's wrong with setting lambda equal to 0?
Oh, you can set lambda equal to 0 everywhere, except this is no longer a solution.
But F would be what?
Yes, if you set lambda consistently to, if you set lambda consistently to zero everywhere, then let's start with J. Then J equals zero says F equals zero. Okay. If you follow everything through, then F dot just ends up being zero. And this is the solution you get in Minkowski space now. So you're right, you can't set lambda equal to zero. And you get Minkowski space.
The old factorized and those are just constraints.
Yes.
And so now we have the singular solution. So it implies something not right, that you actually have to solve all the constraints of Hamiltonian GR. Is that right or not?
Well, what this is a solution. This is a solution, classically, to all the constraints. That's not so surprising. It was before. In the form, I mean, you can take the Sitter space the way it's usually written and plug it into these equations, and you get zero. So the fact that you have a solution to the constraints Now, it's not surprising. The interesting stuff comes later. That is, to what extent can you make these into operator equations and really define them, because this is quantum field theory. So really define them after a regularization procedure as honest operators on the space of honest quantum states inside of an inner product and so forth. And can you do it in such a way that you can demonstrate consistency quantum mechanically, which is very non-trivial and was not done before, and roughly speaking, the state of the art is that all the solutions to these, to this and this, are known explicitly, and that's the space of states I told you about in the first hour, and infinite numbers of these are known in terms of certain recursion relations. Once you've made honest operators, so, and again, I mean, you know, in this form, nobody ever succeeded in finding a regularization procedure that translated these into honest operators, such that their commutator algebra didn't have anomalies. So typically, why the field ground to a halt is that people would have some scheme to make operators out of these. They'd start computing their commutators, and they would get additional equations, which were anomalies, additional operator equations. And therefore, the system of quantum operator equations didn't close. Okay. Whereas there are regularization procedures such that these do go into close into systems of operators that are closed under commutators. Okay.
Wasn't it that you said that the basic feature why these equations are simple is that they are polynomial? But isn't that only the case in the Euclidean?
No. There is, so I know what you're, so there is a way of writing them in the Lorentzian case in which, so the way that I wrote it, this is density wave 2. If I wanted to make a density wave 1, I would have to do what I did here, which is divide by square root of 2, and it looks non-polynomial. Mm-hmm. Something that you know, okay, because of where you've studied, and but most people here don't know, is that even then, there's a beautiful little trick invented by Thomas Tiemann, where even then you can turn it into an operator equation. But you can also turn it into an operator equation just in the form I've written it in the density wave 2. He knows, or he should be teaching the class. Not okay. Okay, so I think that's a lot for today. I said at the beginning, that sometimes we would have to shift, so I have to ask their permission. So I'm the host of the colloquium, and every once in a while there's a speaker that only I have contacted, so therefore I have to host, which is next Wednesday. Would it be terrible if we shift to Thursday next week? Okay, so that's, we'll shift to Thursday. And looking ahead to the schedule, there's only one or two more times in terms when I have to do that. And if I can find willing people to take those speakers and host them, we won't have to switch it all. But I haven't been able to find a host for next Wednesday. Okay. Okay, well thank you very much.